the things that we can't control directly are those things that make us so concerned and so fearful many times. And of course, since I was a little fellow, I've always been amazed and thought about storms a lot and about the uncontrollable nature of storms. And if there's nothing else that exhibits God's power and His, and maybe His fury and maybe His love and care for His people, then storms. And to think about the awesome power that He has, that it's just a tiny, minute part of the power that He has. And I think about the helpless nature of mankind sometimes, and the helpless nature that I feel sometimes when I'm in particular situations, and storms bring that helpless nature out to where I can look at it and make it tangible. And I think about traveling, and recently I went on a trip to Florida for 3 weeks, and I know Anthony spoke the other night. He's made several trips to China here recently. And how helpless you feel as you drive out that driveway, and you realize that you're not going to be home for 21 days to take care of the family that you have. You're not going to be home to take care of the loved ones and all and your house and all the things around. And that you're going to crawl on a plane and you're going to feel this helpless feel of being, that you're not behind the steering wheel and able to turn this thing. You're probably safer than you would be in the car. But you're on this plane and you're helpless. You're at the mercy of somebody else's decisions. And then on this particular trip, as you probably guessed, there was a hurricane in Florida when I was there. Or there wasn't a hurricane, they were expecting a hurricane. There was a tropical storm that came ashore. And so it compounded all this helpless and uncontrollable feel that I had while I was there. And compound all that with homesickness, and I guess you could say it equals homesickness. And I was thinking about this as I was sitting in a hotel room and at work. And I went, and the nature of the position I was in there was not such that I could just say, well, I'm going to go to Kentucky. I'll see you all next week after the storm's passed. And hearing about all the destruction and storm that the previous storms had been, I was right in the area that Hurricane Andrew had. I know Paul Hansel and others had saw that damage firsthand. They're still recovering from that. What was that, 15 years ago? 20 years maybe? I don't know. It's right there in Homestead, part of the time, right where the worst of Hurricane Andrew hit. All the stories that went on, and I don't know anything about hurricanes, and I felt very helpless. And I was at church. I had been to, got there on a Sunday night, and then on Wednesday night I went and met with some saints who worshiped down the street from the hotel. And then on Sunday morning I was back there, and as things were developing and the storm path was changing around, and they're saying, well, it's going to be at 9:00 or real close on Monday morning in the pre-dawn hour. So, of course, Sunday is the first day of the week. I was worshiping God, and I was sitting there waiting for church to start. And I overheard a conversation in the aisle behind me. And the fellow said, well, Sister Julie's not going to be here. And I said, oh, is she sick? No, she stayed at home to prepare, and she's at home preparing for the storm. And I'll never forget, and maybe this is the Christian mentality that I hope I'm supposed to have. I was sitting there, and I think, that's what I'm doing, too. Because I was getting ready to pray about this storm that was going to happen. And I thought, and it made me think about how much different the Christian looks at those uncontrollable events around them than it does somebody else. We have somewhere to turn. Oops, wrong button. And when you can't control your computer. And so I thought, right then, maybe I could prepare a little lesson about preparing for the storm and uncontrollable events. Uncontrollable in quotations. I hope we would put it in quotations by the end of this lesson. As we see and as we develop that maybe there are times that we can, things that we can control that other people can't. And Christ talked about this in Matthew chapter 7, 24 and following. He says, therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him unto a wise man who built his house upon the rock. And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. But everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them, he will be likened to a foolish man who built his house upon the sand. And the rain descended, and the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it fell, and great was its fall. You see, I think that's what Christ was talking about. And was Christ talking about the physical storms, the literal storms, the black cloud that's coming? No, He was probably talking about that, but not only that, but all those forces of trials that come up against us that cause us so much problems in our life, and we need to prepare for those things. Now, do we have the survival kit that for each particular case? Do we have specific tools for tornadoes, for hurricanes, for deaths, and all those other things? Maybe not. But these storms are the trials of life, and we can put together an emergency response kit, if you will, to prepare that is general enough that will take care of us in any situation. These storms come in various forms, as we mentioned. They could be death, and they could be sickness, they could be aging, they could be the economy, the failing economy, the financial system, a loss of a job, a bankruptcy. They could be most anything that causes problems. And our capability to deal with these varies by what type of storm it is. It varies according to what type of person we are, what type of personality we have, what tools we happen to have on hand. You know, if my dog gets sick, I'm in pretty good shape because I don't have to go out and hunt a vet up in the middle of the night unless it's actually surprisingly enough I might have to because vets very, if they don't have any tools, which I don't have any anymore, then it's kind of like building a house without a hammer. You can't hardly do it. But different storms and trials that come at us are handled in different ways, and we have different capabilities. But very few are completely under our control. You know, we can put everything in a graph and in a pie chart and say, well, okay, here's our concerns in our life. And I think that probably whatever day you get up, whatever morning you get up, and depending on the time of the year and the time of this chart would just be skewed all over the place. You know, sometimes we're having a drought right now. That one would probably, for the farmers, be a bigger piece of the pie. But one thing you could say is they all can go into a circle of concern, and I'll go ahead and admit for those of you who have read Stephen Covey's book, Seven Habits of Highly Successful People, I stole this from there, but I'm going to modify it a little bit. But everything could go into this circle of concern or this pie chart that we looked at. And in that circle of concern, there are some things that you can influence. But if you notice that this circle in the society looks big, but if you've ever cut a hay field, Kevin, you know that by the time you get to, if you start out here and you cut down to here, if you have that much left, you're about ready to go to supper. There's not much left there, and that is not much that you can influence within yourself. And then I go one step further and say that there is a section of this that's totally and wholeheartedly within our personal control. And that's almost like I can tie my shoe if I want to, or I can go to work if I want to. But there's very, very little in our life, if you think about it, that we come in contact with, very few happenings that we are in, percentage-wise, that we are in direct personal control. And we can do it without any communication, without any influencing or influence from another person or another thing. But that's there, and do we have an influence? And then all this out here is just beyond our influence. But we can learn to control the storms a little bit. We can learn some things that will help us deal with these things. We understand that all people are subject to these trials. And we understand that we can't stop most trials. And we understand, though, that we can head off some trials. You know, we don't have to worry about causing a drunk driving accident if we don't drink. We can influence many and reduce the force because if we got a friend who drinks, we can take their keys away from them. And we can prepare, though, for those other storms that we have no other control over. And we need to create an action plan. This action plan needs to be something reasonable, something that is tenable, something that is doable, and something that will lead to the results we want. Something better than a floating toolbox. So, and then in every action plan, before we even get started, there are always inappropriate elements in a plan. And if you know me, I'm all about whenever I figure out something and learn something, I'm always wanting to apply it to something. I'm always trying to figure out a way that We could be do something better. But it doesn't include doing nothing. And it doesn't include waiting and seeing. It doesn't include ignoring the warnings. And it doesn't include procrastinating. You know, we had a couple of tremendously terrible events in the United States in the last few years. One being Hurricane Katrina, the other being September 11th. They had some other things that happened worldwide with terrorist events and the tsunami and all these different things. And those of us who are left on the earth to mourn the passing of those who lost their lives, and to mourn and help deal with those who have lost so much, we need to understand that we can't just put it aside and wait for it to happen again. We thought we were prepared before 9/11. In Louisiana, everybody thought they were prepared officially thought they were prepared. But if there were some glaring and obvious inadequacies in the preparation. I remember Mary Lee and several of us from this group were on a bus tour down there. And the woman at Louisiana and in New Orleans, and this woman who was doing the tour, she was showing us the levees, and she said, if they ever get a Category 3 or 4 hurricane, then everybody expects these levees to bring in flood of 10 Kilometer people. Guess what happened? That was the tour bus director. I mean, the tour bus guy. She knew it. But see, sometimes we do the same as some of our politicians, and we ignore the warning signs. But we don't need to do that. We need to get an action plan. So within that action plan, I've got a few suggestions. There's a lot more could go in there. But one is to become a new creature. You know, we don't need to just obey the gospel. And I should have rephrased that. Obeying the gospel would be the whole package. You know, we need to obey the gospel, the whole word of God. Sometimes we equate obeying the gospel with the beginning. We walk down the aisle and we become baptized. And we hear and we go through the five steps of salvation and we get started on the way, and we call that obeying the gospel. But that's not really what obeying the gospel is. Obeying the gospel is what Christ said in John 14:15, if you love me, keep my commandments. And that way, that's the whole package. So not just obey the gospel, but to change our way, change the way, who we are, become a new creature. Galatians chapter 2 and verse 20 addresses this fairly head on, where Paul, writing to the Galatians, says in verse 20, I have been crucified with Christ. It is no longer I who live, but Christ lives in me, and the life which I now live is that I now live in the flesh. I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave himself for me. Now that's what Paul said, how he was living his life. What happened to the old man that he put away? It just went away. It's dead. It's buried. It's buried with Christ. Can't look at it anymore. In Romans chapter 12 and verse 2, he's writing to the Romans. And he spends a lot of time on this in Romans. Probably, actually, you could read about this a lot in Paul's writings in general. Romans 12 and verse 2, and do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is that good and acceptable and perfect will of God. Renewing your mind. What does renewing mean? Becoming new again. Starting over. Cleaning and purging your mind and starting over again. So in doing this, we will find a new way of thinking. We evaluate and react to events in our lives totally different than we did before. When the storm is coming, we may run around and try to nail boards on our house to keep the wind from blowing in, and that would be advisable. But we also pray to God, and we have a lot of influence over that storm because of our prayers. When the drought comes and we go days and days and days without rain, who needs to be the ones working to get that stopped? Are you going to go to President Bush? Are you going to go to the legislature? Are you going to have hope in Barack Obama or John McCain or Sarah Palin and Joe Biden to bring that rain to you to make things better? They can't do it, folks. God can do it. God is the powerful one in the universe. And He's the one we need to be talking to about these things. And so we have a new manner of decision making. We have a new manner of deciding whether or not and what we're going to do, because we always do it in the light of how is this going to affect the Christians around me? How is this going to help lead people to Christ? And how is this going to make God happy when we make the decision to do things? And we have a new happiness. You know, Steve was reading back in a few months ago one of the passages that he chose to read on Wednesday night, in the Psalms chapter 37. And the way he read it, the way he emphasized it, some way it hit me. I've read this passage before several times, but some way it hit me what I think God was meaning in this, the way it was read. Maybe this version it's reading from, I don't know. But in verse 4 he says, "Delight yourself also in the Lord, and he shall give you the desires of your heart." Actually, I think in one version that I read says, "Delight yourself in the ways of the Lord, and He shall give you the desires of your heart." And then verse 5, "Commit your way to the Lord and trust also in Him, and He shall bring it to pass." And I've thought about that verse a lot. Delight yourself in the ways of the Lord. And the way I've got that written on there is not really what I mean. Where it says new things make us happy, I'm saying different things make us happy as Christians when we learn to want and be happy with what God wants us to have. I can tell you how to be happy tomorrow. I can tell you how to be happy tonight. As happy as you can be. Want what the Lord wants for you. Decide that makes me happy. And then you can be happy. 100% guarantee that you'll be happy if you want what the Lord wants for you. Pretty simple. Pretty simple to say. Unfortunately, it's hard sometimes for us to put aside that old man and to become the new creature. Number two, action plan number two, build faith. You know, over in Hebrews chapter 11, we read about faithful people. Faith's Hall of Fame, we sometimes call it. There's a lot of people that are faithful that are mentioned in there. You know, we could read about Abraham and Sarah and Noah and Enoch, and we could read about Abel, and we could read about several others. Isaac and Jacob and Joseph, and there's Moses and his parents, and we could read about Joshua and Israel, and we could read about Rahab and several others. One's named Barak, who's faithful. Samson, Jephthah. A lot of people in there, and I want to ask you, how did they build that faith? Where did these characters get that much faith? Because was it just given to them? I was passing by some church building here a few months ago, and I saw a marquee that said, "Faith is a gift, but you got to ask for it." Well, I think I agree with that to a certain extent. But, you know, I'm not sure that that's all there is to it, that you just ask for it. I think that there's more to it. I think we need to mold ourselves and allow ourselves to be molded. We need to allow ourselves to grow in faith. And I think we need to work consciously to build faith. And I think about, out of all those people and of all the stories in the Bible, there's two people and two scenarios that exhibit faith above and beyond all the others. And you may see it a little different, and I'm not saying that we need to compare them. But two things stand out in my mind. And one is one we talk about a lot, and that's Jesus and God's sacrifice on the cross. The other is almost as impacting to my faith, and that's Abraham's offering of Isaac upon the altar. You know, back in Genesis chapter 12, he started out being with this request. Or he started out, actually, with this promise that Abraham was going to have a child. And Abraham wanted a child. And he wanted to, he'd been wanting it, and he was 75 years old, and it was beginning to look like he wasn't going to have it. And it took a long time for that to come to pass. And we see, as we go through Abraham's life, that this faith was built over a long period of time. And I've mentioned this before. And I mentioned this as we were going through it in our Bible study. But it took us a long time to study, just to study on Wednesday night, all the activities of Abraham. You know, in Genesis 12, verse 1 through 3, we see the divine call, where God called Abraham and asked him to go out and do certain things. And he said, "You're going to have children. And your children are going to bless, are going to bring about the blessing for all other families on this earth."
He was talking about Christ.
Abraham probably didn't understand what he was talking about. He was, all he knew was he was 75 years old. He had wanted a son all his life, and he never could have one. And now God's promising him a son, and he probably was a little bit hard to believe. Then in Genesis chapter 16, they had waited several years. Abraham and Sarah had waited several years for children. They waited several years since the promise that God made. And no children.
Now, you know, he's 75 years old. God says, I'm going to bring you children. He says, well, you know, I don't know, maybe God doesn't believe. So yeah, they have a little falter in their faith.
Now, remember that falters in their faith, if they're handled right, are very faith-building things themselves. So they had Hagar and brought her in, and she had a child by Abraham. And then a few more years passed by. In Genesis chapter 21, Isaac is born. Now that's 25 years after the promise was made to Abraham. He's 100 years old. I'm 39 years old with a young child, and I don't know that I could have handled one at 100. I'll tell you, this is some long nights. 100 years old. And then in Genesis 19, we see a visit from the angels, and he witnesses the destruction, or is a part of the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. We see then in Genesis 22, and many other things, by the way, I'm sure happened that weren't recorded, some other things that were recorded, that were faith-building things. By the time he's asked to sacrifice his son, he's well over 100 years old. And he's worked with God and lived with God and walked this life that God has asked him to live for quite some time. And he's built some faith. I don't think that God would have asked him to do that 2 days after he became a Christian. But I also don't think that if Moses had lived his godly life the way some of us do nowadays, I don't think that 100 years of experience in faith building being a Christian would make much difference. Because sometimes we just don't grow. Sometimes we become Christians and that's it. We stop. We never progress past that point. And so, when we face trials, guess what? We're like the man who built his house upon the sand. We just waver all over the place, and many times we crash. How many times have you known people who are supposedly Christians, and some trial of their life comes up? Maybe they lose a family member or something, and they just fall to pieces. They've even blamed God for it. We can't do that, folks, and we've got to get ourselves ready because these storms are coming. Action item number 3, we need to draw near to God. You know, in James chapter 4 and verse 8, James hits this head on. He draws this, he addresses this directly. James chapter 4 and verse 8, he says, and well, start at verse 7. Therefore submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinner, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. Lament and mourn and weep, and let your laughter be turned to mourning and your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and He will lift you up. We need to draw near to God. We need to be close to Him. And we need to lament and mourn over the things that we've done in the past. The life that we lived that was without Jesus. The life that we lived even last week, whenever we weren't as strong as we are today. We need to learn to put that old man beside us. Behind us, and allow God. And Danny just mentioned this story. This story Wednesday night. That you know, God is always there. We're the ones that move away from Him. Like the what Danny mentioned Wednesday night of the old couple that were following the young couple, and the young couple were in their pickup truck and all huddled up together, and the old couple is in their truck and. The woman, the wife's sitting over here, and the man's over in the driver's seat, and she says, why don't we do that anymore? And he said, well, I haven't gone anywhere. He was still behind the steering wheel. She's the one that migrated to the passenger side. And that's the way. God doesn't go anywhere. God is always there for us if we will come. And He's with us. He's the only one that goes with us, by the way, whenever we're on an airplane, and whenever we're enduring a hurricane, or whether we're having a drought, or whether our crops won't grow, there's only one person that can solve that problem for us, and that's God. 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 7, Peter talks about this a little bit. He says in verse 6, "Therefore humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that He may exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon Him, for He cares for you. Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking Him He may devour. Resist Him steadfastly in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world." Realize that these trials are not brought upon you because you're a Christian. They're not going to not be brought upon you because you're a Christian. We are all going to undergo the trials. Cast your cares upon Him. No, I'm not saying don't nail boards over your windows in the face of the hurricane, but I'm saying nail the boards on and then turn to God and lay it on Him. Because when the rubber meets the road, and whenever you've exhausted everything you can do in that circle of concern, in that circle of control, your only other option is to go to God. And get it straight. Get your priorities straight. Matthew chapter 6 and verse 33. Well, before Matthew 6 and verse 33, Christ is talking about this very thing. He's saying, he's talking about worrying, talking about dealing with problems that are many times beyond your control. And he says, he culminates the whole discussion in verse 33 when he says, "But seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you." All the things that we need in this life, and much, much more most of the time, will be added to us if we get it straight. Are we going to get some of those things if we don't seek God first? Of course we are. And that's one of the things that leads us on. That's one of the biggest tools of the devil, is success without God. So many times, we are successful. We have a nice house, and we have a nice car, and it's because we work hard, and it's because we live in a good economy and a good country, but it's mostly because God allowed us to have it in spite of the way we treat Him. Thinking about something the other night during class, says, you know, I don't remember who the president was. I won't even attempt, because you'll laugh at me if I get it wrong. Said, ask not what you can do for your country, but ask not what the country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. And I think that's pretty appropriate. We don't need to ask what God can do for us so much as we need to ask what we can do for God, because you know what? God has already done it. He's already done more than we will ever deserve. So it's there. It's on deposit. We just need to go by and pick it up. Action item 4, and we're drawing close to the end. Expand your influence. You know, Matthew chapter 5 and verse 13, and I don't remember who just did a little touched on this in a lesson recently, but I remember the lesson. Says, "You are the salt of the earth," Christ Himself talking, "but if the salt loses its flavor, how shall it be seasoned? It is then good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. You are the light of the world. A city that is set on the hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on the lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. So let your light shine before men, so that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven." What is he saying here? He's saying that if you have lost your influence, I think in verse 13 there, if you have lost your influence as a Christian, or as not a Christian, you're no good for anything but to be thrown out and trampled underfoot by men. I didn't say that. That's what that says right there. I think that's what that says. It says you Christians are the salt of the earth. And if you lose your flavor, that is your influence, you're no good for nothing. We don't want to be that way, folks. We don't want to lose our influence. We need to preserve our influence over anything else. You know, we see also another example. There's many examples in the New Testament of influencing, but we see in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 2, and we won't read it for the sake of time, but the influence of a wife over her husband. The wife lives a good life in front of her unbelieving husband, and many are won because of that. We need to be a part of the church's work. Over in 2 Corinthians chapter 9 is another example of where Paul was talking to the Corinthians. And he talked to them about a lot of things they were doing wrong, but he says one thing to them that was a few things that are good. In verse 2, he says, "For I know your willingness, about which I boast of you to the Macedonians, that Achaia was ready a year ago, and your zeal has stirred up the majority." Isn't that neat? Isn't that neat how a group of Christians, a small group of Christians there in Corinth, could stir up the majority with their zeal, their excitement, their fervor for serving God? We need to be a part of the church's work. And I realize we got some folks here, man, who work so hard and who do work hard to be a part of the church's work. But as we grow, we need to develop that a little bit further. We need to step a little bit closer to the edge of our comfort zone. And that may eventually lead somebody to growing into a lot of preacher. It may lead somebody to grow into somebody that could lead a prayer in the service. And it may lead somebody who has never done it to be able to talk to somebody at work. If everybody in this building is growing the way they should, then we won't have this problem that I saw in Miami, by the way. There was another problem I had in Miami that I saw. And I went to church, I mentioned on Wednesday night, there were three people there. I was one of them. Three people. And I go, and on Sunday morning, it was a big building, almost as big as this. On Sunday morning, there was, probably 40 or 50 people there. And I asked this fellow, I said, "Wonder, you know, I was kind of talking to him, and asking what happened to all these people." But he said, everybody got out of the mood, kind of lost their interest in being Christians, and it happened, you know, we just lost a few here, lost a few there. Now we got three people on Wednesday night, and generally only have two. They do have one guy that comes every once in a while on Wednesday night. You see, these folks weren't a part of the church's work. And I see it, I know, we talk about it a lot, Steve, and Pat and Corey and Josh and Aaron, I mean, all these folks, everybody, when we go to be preaching these little other congregations, these churches, they've got a lot of pews, they've got a lot of space, and they were full at one point. But apathy and concerns of the world have pulled people apart. And it's hard, I know. It's very hard. And Mary Lee and I have got so much to do, and we just about, you know, before church this morning, we're trying to fit in everything during the day, and I said, "I've got leadership class tonight." Oh man, I forgot about that, you know. And you just got to squeeze it in, but you could say, "Well, let's just don't do some of these extra things." Well, we can't really do that because that creates a place where we're going backwards in the church. If we're going to go backwards in something, let's do it at work, or let's do it somewhere else in our life. Let's cut it somewhere else in our life. Let's not cut it out of the church. Because the influence is more than what I can do myself. So we want to have zeal, and we want to have encouragement. We want to create excitement for people. And we need to stay qualified to pray. You know, we realize in John 9:31, where Christ was talking to, they were questioning Christ's authority, and he was doing a lot of debate amongst the groups that were there. And they said, and they're trying to reason out how he had performed a miracle. And it says, "For we know that God does not hear a sinner's prayer." They say it almost like it's an accepted fact. Now, I think we can have a lot of debate over what God hears and what he answers and so forth. But the point is, that we could go to a lot of other places, and we know that a person who doesn't serve God has very little influence over the decision God makes. Whereas, we turn over James 5:16. "Confess your trespasses to one another and pray for one another that you may be healed. The effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man availeth much." Now there you go. You know that effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. Whereas almost by implication he's saying that the prayer of a non-righteous man doesn't really avail much. And then we put John 9:31, a few verses in Proverbs with it, you find out really that's probably true. So whenever my children are growing up and they've got a fever and I can't figure out what it is, or whenever my bank account ain't looking like it's supposed to and I'm working every hour of the day that I can, or whenever my good friend's wife is on her deathbed and I can't control any of it, where's the only other place that I can turn? It's to God. And if I've ruined that relationship with God, I don't have anywhere. So it's truly uncontrollable. Prayer enables us to influence all areas of this concern. You see, we had this personal control, which wasn't much. We had this influence, which really wasn't much more. But with God, we can pretty much take the blue out of this chart. And then we prepare, number five, for the worst case scenario. Of course, the worst case scenario may be the best case scenario if we've lived our life according to the way we should. The worst case scenario and the response plan is that everybody dies. Well, guess what? We're going to die anyway. The worst case scenario is always going to happen from a physical standpoint because we're all going to die. Revelation 14, verse 13. Then I heard the voice from heaven saying to me, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors and their works follow them. What a tremendous worst case scenario. Once all my work here is done, and once I've done what I need to do, I'm looking forward to the worst case scenario. I'm looking forward to some rest. Get a good night's sleep for a change. Be diligent to make our eternal rest sure. We have got to be diligent, folks. Everybody in the religious world loves to preach that we can't do anything to influence our salvation. We can't do anything to influence whether or not we go to heaven or not because God just gave it to us. But that's not the case. And we see in 2 Peter chapter 1 that Paul, Peter himself says in verse 10 of this salvation. That's 1 Peter. 2 Peter chapter 1. He says in verse 10, therefore, brethren, be even more diligent to make your call and election sure, for if you do these things, you will never stumble. For so an entrance will be supplied to you abundantly in the everlasting kingdom of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. We need to work. We never get anything without any effort whatsoever. There's just no way. It won't be done without a conscious decision on our part. And we also need to realize, in the worst case scenario, because death is not always the worst case, worst physical scenario. That sometimes that's the easiest thing in a set of choices. But we also need to realize when there's tremendous suffering going on, that Paul said in Romans that all things work together for good for those who love God, to those who are called according to His purpose. Did he say all things work together for good for everybody? No. He didn't say that. He said for those who love God. And if we love God and we do what we're supposed to be doing, it'll come out with a happy ending. No question about it. And then the last action item that I would suggest is that we establish and understand and gain peace beyond understanding that Paul talks about in Philippians 4. The peace of Christ, the peace of God, that is beyond understanding. And Marilyn mentioned this the other day, something that somebody was going through a trial and she had mentioned it like, you know, well, they're not a Christian. This person's definitely not a Christian. And she said, this person just doesn't get the peace, doesn't have the peace beyond understanding, so they don't know how to take care of this situation. They don't know how to deal with it, and they're about to lose their mind. And it's almost like we take this for granted, that this peace of God, which passes understanding, is there every day, every moment of our lives, and it's always there for us to draw on. And it's what we learn to lean on. And that keeps people like me who are very emotional and tend to let things bother me. It keeps me out of the loony bin, I just tell you. So we need to hear God and we need to believe that Jesus came and lived and died on this earth as a sinless man. We need to believe that the answers are there for us in God's Word. We need to confess those facts and all according to Romans chapter 10. And then we need to repent and be baptized according to Acts chapter 2, verse 38. For the remission of sins, referenced Steve's sermon 2 weeks ago on baptism. And we need to be faithful until death. That we read in Revelation chapter 2 and verse 10. That it's just not a one-time thing where we start it and then it's all done and we just sit around and wait and live our lives the way we want to until Christ comes back or until we die. Wait, if there's anything that we can help you with this morning, if you need to respond to the call of Christ or you need to get back on the right track, we're here to help you. We'll do whatever needs to be done. And so please come forward as we stand and sing the invitation hymn.